Welcome back to Dig This, Nuka's official podcast and our latest episode. Well, America did it again. We held an election and it produced gridlock on Capitol Hill. The Democrats will hold on to the Senate by a narrow margin, and the House will probably switch to the Republicans with an equally narrow margin of control. These changes and potential roadblocks in Congress will have a large influence on the utility construction's legislative agenda in 2023. Joining us today on Dig This is Zach Perconti, Nuka's Vice President of Government Affairs, to talk about the 2022 congressional elections and what it means to Nuka's membership. Welcome back, Zach, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I know we talked over the last 2 weeks about this election and how hard it was for political observers like us to get a read on where the election is going. What is your take on the results?
Well, Bob, I got to say, I think a lot of folks were really surprised by what happened. Going into last week's election, we're recording this about a week afterwards. The House has still not officially been called, although it looks like Republicans are going to have a very narrow, maybe even as low as 1-2 seat majority. Senate's been called for the Democrats so far. Even regardless of what happens in the Senate race in Georgia, they're going to have at least a 1-seat majority there. Going into that election, folks really were not expecting that. I think a lot of folks were really banking on Republicans making pretty significant gains. The conventional wisdom was that we were going to see a red wave. Now, looking back, I don't even think we saw a red ripple. I think we saw pretty much an even split and a deadlocked House. That is really quite unexpected. Traditionally, according to conventional wisdom, the president's party will lose pretty significant grounds in the first midterm. We usually, in the past couple of decades, in the modern political era, have seen that hold mostly true. In most elections, Republicans or Democrats, whoever's looking to gain control, will easily pick up at least 10 seats. And they had a real shot to do that in both chambers. They could have picked up at least 4 or 5 Senate seats. They could have picked up at least 12 to 15, 20, or even more House seats. And so I think a lot of Republicans have got to be pretty upset with the way that things happened on Tuesday. I know a lot of Democrats are frankly considering it as a victory, even if they lost one of the chambers.
What do you think the reasons were for this big divergence from what everyone was expecting?
Well, it's interesting because now that we have the benefit of hindsight, we can kind of look at this. And a lot of the signs, I think, for this overperformance were really there. When you look at a lot of the special elections that we've had since the Supreme Court handed down the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, Democrats have pretty consistently overperformed in those elections. There were a couple of races, even one up in New York, a special election where even the polling was pretty convincingly favoring the Republican to win that seat. And the Democrats massively outperformed expectations and actually managed to win that special election. So I think you have to consider the Dobbs decision as a pretty major part of this. The Republican Party really now finds itself as a crossroads of where do they want to go for 2024. I think you have to ask the question, does the former president still hold the appeal that he used to for a lot of Americans? When you look down in Florida, that is really the big bright spot for Republicans out of Tuesday's results. The red wave did arrive in Florida. DeSantis won convincingly by his margin of victory was in the double digits. Republicans managed to flip a lot of seats in Florida. So you really kind of have to ask yourself, does DeSantis's appeal represent the future for the Republican Party? Is that what folks are looking for? Or are they still interested in President Trump running for re-election? Well, while we're recording this, there are, of course, rumors that he's going to announce his re-election campaign any day now. I expect we'll see a very contentious Republican Party primary for that presidential election in the next couple of years.
Zach, one of the reasons the Democrats did so well was the youth turnout.
Absolutely.
Which was, I know because I've been doing politics now for 20 years, they always say they're going to come and vote and they never do. They always statistically lower marches. This election, to their credit, they exercised their franchise. Where do you see that going in terms of future elections? Because they're going to be our future workforce as well, too.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. What are the issues that are important to young voters across the country? And I think that three of the issues that were, I think, really high on folks' lists, when you look at what priorities a lot of these young voters have, issues like student debt forgiveness, issues like marijuana legalization, which, if you'll recall, the Biden administration did announce action at potentially reclassifying marijuana from a Schedule 1 drug to a lower Schedule 2 drug or below, even potentially. And then again, you have to look at things like the Dobbs decision. I know that motivated a lot of young voters to turn out as well. Folks absolutely were concerned about the other issues, of course. If you look at the exit polling, as well as a lot of the pre-election polling, folks were absolutely concerned about the economy. Folks were concerned about inflation. Folks were concerned about crime. So all of those issues definitely did play into things. And I think those issues are part of the reasons why Republicans did really perform well in states like Florida, why Republicans overperformed expectations in New York, and why they may hold on to the House, frankly, because of a few races in states like Arizona and California that have yet to be called. But Republicans are generally favored in a lot of those seats. But when it comes to young voters, I think a lot of those social issues are really what got them to turn out.
With the Republicans possibly taking over the House, what will that mean for the committees we follow? Representative Sam Graves in Missouri, the Nuke-endorsed ranking member on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee today, looks like he'll take over the chairman's gavel. Other committees will get new chairmen who decide the fate of bills moving through their committees. What will these leadership changes mean for our 118th Congress agenda?
So that's an excellent question, and it's really a tricky one to answer right now, simply because, one, the House, again, at the time of us recording this, still hasn't been called, and two, what we're currently expecting based on what votes are still left to be counted is that Republicans are going to have one of the narrowest majorities in congressional history. It's possible that they will have a 1-3 seat majority when all of the votes have been counted. To put that into perspective, across the whole of the 117th Congress, the current Congress, there has not been a single day where there has not been at least one vacant seat in the House of Representatives. Currently, there are three vacancies in the House of Representatives. So to say that there is absolutely no margin for error really, I think, is almost understating just how tight and difficult it's going to be to manage the votes for the majority, whoever they may be. Whoever holds the chairman's gavel is going to have a hard time managing their caucus, and he or she is going to need to make some tough decisions on who holds the gavels in order to keep as many people happy as they can. We're very confident that Sam Graves, of course, will be chair of T&I. We've developed a really positive working relationship with him and his team over the years. They've got a lot of great ideas that we're really excited to work with them on. But when it comes to talking about legislation, that's going to be a little more challenging. For one, the Democrats are still going to hold the Senate. Republicans are going to likely have the House, but even if they don't, I think the filibuster is still relatively safe because at most, Democrats will end up with 51 seats, assuming they manage to win the runoff in Georgia. They have at least two senators, Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona and Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who have still gone on record that they're opposed to doing away with the filibuster. So if the Democrats were to hold on to both chambers, we would see, I think, a fairly similar pattern of legislation that we've had these last 2 years. They're likely going to lose the House, which means that big pieces of legislation are going to be nigh on impossible to make it through both chambers. Unless we're looking at bipartisan bills, and we do have a few in mind that we're hoping to get some traction on, we're likely going to see pretty much exclusively must-pass legislation actually make it all the way through the process to the president's desk. And when I say must-pass legislation, I'm mostly talking about essential spending bills. So government funding, reauthorization of the various agencies, things like the National Defense Authorization Act, raising the debt ceiling. We're looking at potentially Congress doing that in the lame duck period to avoid a potential standoff over that issue, but that is very important to the global economy that that is done properly and on time. Those are really the only sorts of bills we're looking at. And so a lot of NUCA's priorities, I think, when we look at legislative accomplishments, are going to be smaller, targeted policy fixes that we can hopefully have attached to those broader packages. I think what we're really looking at from the House over the next couple of years is mostly going to be oversight. The administration is likely to move a lot of their agenda to the regulatory side of things. Of course, we're also still tracking implementation of the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act that NUCA was aggressively involved in championing and moving across the finish line. We're going to be really relying on a lot of the folks in the House, a lot of the Republicans there, to hold the administration accountable, to make sure that they're meeting their goals on time and on budget as close as possible. And just to work with us and work with the administration as partners to ensure that that legislation is responsibly implemented.
We've been working on some legislative priorities for the upcoming session. You mentioned one. Can you share some details about these other priorities, such as private activity bonds? I know some of these will be our legislative asks at our May Washington summit.
Absolutely. So I think private activity bonds are really the perfect example of the sort of targeted fixes that we're looking to accomplish in the next year. Private activity bonds are a relatively small change when you look at it through legislation. The language that we are looking at, that we've been pushing, is really not much. It's a couple pages at most. Really only a couple of lines hold most of the meat of that change, which, of course, for those of you who are listening to me now and haven't heard of this policy before, would be lifting the state volume cap on private activity bonds for water and wastewater construction. That policy already largely exists for other types of construction. Waste management, for instance, airports are another instance. The infrastructure bill contained similar language for broadband projects, which we're also going to be looking at making, I believe it's 75% exempt, fully exempt from the state volume cap, which just limits how many of these can be issued. The advantage to a private activity bond, of course, is that it's outside money in a project, but the project is still owned by the public. It's not privatizing the project. It's just simply providing an avenue for investment and a very safe and stable avenue. The rate of default on these is so low that it's, for all intents and purposes, 0%. So it's a very positive change. It's a very small change, but we've always had trouble just finding the right vehicle for it. This Congress is going to be an avenue more for those sorts of pieces of legislation, just small targeted fixes that really don't amount to a whole much in terms of pieces of paper in the legislation, and we'll be working to try to get those things through. Other areas we're going to be looking at are, I think we're going to have a lot of focus on labor issues still. Of course, this industry still needs to hire. There are a lot of positions that need to be filled, and there are a lot of federal contracts that are coming over the next few years that, you know, it's going to be tough to do some of those jobs if we don't have the people to do them. And so our priority is going to be making sure that, one, the government kind of stays out of its own way in ensuring that the industry has the tools that it needs and is allowed to have the freedom to maneuver to accomplish these jobs. But then also we're going to be looking at promoting workforce development. We're going to be looking at promoting technical education and potentially other avenues for getting folks into the workforce, be they, you know, currently in the United States or potentially looking at coming to the United States to work in these positions.
Is part of that immigration reform of some sorts?
So immigration reform is a very challenging issue in an ordinary Congress. In a Congress that's this narrowly divided, it's going to be really challenging to, I think, find something that we can get enough votes to move through. But it doesn't mean we might not try. We're absolutely looking at all of our options here. I think that just about everyone can agree that our country's system is broken right now. We'll be looking at lots of different policies, but I think that one that is absolutely achievable is some sort of action on H-2B visa reform to allow, again, folks to come into the country to work seasonally in the industry. We're also potentially looking at a new category of visas. There's been legislation proposed to create a category called H-2C visas, and that would really mostly just be for the construction industry and related fields. Again, providing an avenue to get more bodies into the workforce. You know, as at the time of recording this, national unemployment is, I believe, around 3.5%. That is classified as full employment. So it's really challenging to find people to fill these positions. And one of the things that the administration and Congress have started to change their language on, but, you know, still does concern me a little bit, is when we talk about the bipartisan infrastructure law, IIJA, a lot of the language that they're still using is around creating jobs. They talk about, for instance, the broadband money, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, or the BEAD program, which is going to be a $42.5 billion program of broadband construction nationwide, with the goal of having every American with access to affordable broadband by the year 2030. They talk about this program as something that's very exciting for a number of reasons. One, because it'll expand access to everyone, but two, it's going to create hundreds of thousands of new jobs. Well, the concern that I immediately have about that is, where are the hundreds of thousands of people that are trained in those positions ready to take those jobs? We don't have that yet. So the industry, I know, is doing its part to fill those positions and to train people, but we really do need federal support if we're going to meet that target. And I think that that's a message that we can take to Congress next year that is really going to resonate with folks both on the Hill and in the administration.
Speaking of the administration, with this party change in the House comes a change in the Biden administration's agenda. We'll continue working with the White House and their supply chain initiative to free up import bottlenecks and source materials domestically. But are there issues that you see the administration pursuing through executive actions or increased regulations that we would disagree with?
So when you look at what House Democrats wanted to accomplish in the 117th Congress but weren't able to, I think you're going to see a lot of those issues continue to move through the executive branch and the regulatory apparatus. And I think top of those is really questions about labor issues. The administration, generally speaking, has really strongly advocated for increased union presence in a lot of different sectors of the economy. And, you know, construction is obviously one of those that they've really pushed over the last couple of years. Of course, the PRO Act, the very large labor bill that House Democrats have pushed for the last couple of Congresses, they're not able to get that across the finish line as long as the filibuster is intact. I think you'll continue to see the administration look at pieces of the PRO Act that they may be able to implement through regulatory rulemakings, and they'll try to continue moving that through that process. I think you'll also continue when we're looking at the infrastructure bill to see project labor agreements either required or strongly encouraged in notices of funding opportunity and other rulemakings and announcements that they issue. You'll also continue to see them take action on supply chain and materials to further push a lot of the domestic manufacturing agenda that they've really kind of put front and center. So those are all things that we'd look at. We don't necessarily disagree with all of those, but when you look at the actual nuances of those regulations, I think that's something we're really going to have to go to with a fine-tooth comb. That is, I think, just the start, though, of the various different priorities that the administration is going to try to move through the executive branch. Now that, again, it appears they've lost control of one of the houses of Congress, at least for the foreseeable future, while the House is in Republican hands, I do expect the administration to really aggressively push a lot of their priorities through the executive branch.
With the conclusion of another election season, we're already here, believe it or not, in the 2024 cycle. Even though NUCA does not take an official position on a candidate, the 24 election will affect in terms of how we're all going to be looking at our agenda in Congress, a potential agenda in Congress in the 119th Congress, which would start January 2025.
So as much as I hate to start thinking about the 2024 election when we haven't even started the 118th Congress, that is the way our country's elections work. You know, as soon as one wraps up, we're pretty much immediately on to the next one. I will say that NUCA will be, you know, and continue to be very actively involved and engaged in the congressional process. In the congressional elections for next cycle, you know, we'll continue to be very active there as well. I will encourage folks to get involved, really, is I think what my take on the 24 cycle is. Start getting involved now. Start getting involved in what's happening in this Congress. NUCA has a number of ways you can do that, of course, from our muster grassroots system to participating in our annual Washington Summit to just, you know, giving a phone call or sending an email to your friendly vice president of government affairs. There are lots of different ways that you can get involved and stay engaged. I think that being engaged with your chapters on both state and local issues, as well as our national issues, is another good way to start getting involved. The thing is, when you're looking at the 2024 cycle, momentum for campaigns and momentums for issues that are going to matter starts now. And those do affect what happens in the next Congress. And so my message to NUCA members is it's really not too early to get involved and to get engaged. And if you're already engaged, please stay that way and think about how you can take that next step. I really encourage you to look at NUCA's advocacy webpage. There are other ways that you can get involved directly in campaigns as well. We have some information on our website about that. If you ever have any questions about our government affairs department, our inboxes are always open. So do please feel free to reach out. Zach, ZACKP@NUCA.com.
Zach, thanks for your time today. I enjoyed listening to your educated thoughts about this election and NUCA's advocacy and legislative agenda in 2023 and beyond.
I'm always happy to talk government affairs and elections. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to Dig This, NUCA's official podcast. Please remember, safety first in all of our work.